The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the December 10th installment of The Heretics Hour, coming to you live from the White Network. I'm your host tonight, Carolyn Yeager, and I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. The call-in number is 830-443-4911, and the write-in address is carolyn@carolynyeager.net. Remember that now, no more .com, carolynyeager.net. I have been getting emails with that address, so people are catching on. We are in the dark time of the year. I don't need to tell you that, but I thought I would. The days are shorter. The nights are longer. I do believe that a week from Friday will be the longest night of the year, excuse me, which is December 21st. And even though, well, all of a sudden, I've got a, excuse me, I'm very sorry. Even though Saturday, the 22nd, will be the first official day of winter, the days will start getting longer from that point. I always kind of wondered why they called it the first day of winter when it's actually the change of seasons. But, oh well, the change of the, you know, we're going into the spring season in a sense, but still, it's still winter. So that's the way, that's how it's done. Anyway, I get it, but it always seems a little strange to me. But this is a very special time of year. And we should really be relishing it, and not to forget that Wednesday will be 12-12-12. I think that's very special. Please be aware of it and get the feel of what kind of a day it is. And let me know if you notice anything unusual. I'm going to try to be paying attention. 12-12-12 doesn't come along very often. Because how often do we have a year that ends in 12? And 12 is a very special number, so I think it's kind of special, although I don't hear anybody talking about it. Maybe it will usher in something good, I hope. Anyway, a little more silly discussion here about, to get myself warmed up, and that's that Hanukkah started yesterday, but I have not come across all the menorah stories that we used to get. Has the spirit of Christmas reasserted itself to some degree? Maybe. Maybe so. But tonight I'm going to be talking about something that I think is important, and that is our, that has to do with the mention of Hanukkah and the menorah stories, and that is dealing with the Jewish onslaught on our culture and our society. And something that I've talked about quite a number of times, but I still talk about it because I think it is the number one issue that we have to face and that we have to understand. You know, a listener, Don, actually Don's been a guest on my program for two different times. And he sent me this little slogan, you might say, which I think is very good. I would like to promote it. It's break the taboo, criticize the Jew, because that's the taboo that we're under, that the Jews cannot be criticized. And of course, we can criticize them on the White Network, but mostly in anywhere in, you go in society, it's looked down upon. In fact, people actually freak out if they hear you doing that. So this is what we have to break down. We have to break down this taboo about criticizing the Jew. And it goes along with this same taboo about talking about the Holocaust, or questioning the Holocaust is another taboo that has to be broken down. And a lot of people are working on that. Not as many people work on criticizing the Jew. But when we criticize the Jew, we have to criticize things that are really, that are right to be criticized. We shouldn't just be making insults or slamming Jews or calling them names or, saying outrageous things, even though there might be truth in it. it should be put in a way that's absolutely authentic. I don't want to use that word right now. That's absolutely correct and can be defended and can be explained and you know can be documented. So, but we need to get used to doing that. We need to point that out whenever we can. And I know how difficult it is because I don't want to do it when I'm with people. And just come out with things that I know they're going to be very uncomfortable with and even shocked maybe and just, you know, nobody wants to do that. But when an opportunity comes up, we need to do it. And, so this is what I'm going to be talking about tonight is, what we can learn from the protocols of Zion about what the Jews are up to and how we can use it and why we should use it, not just wildly or without restraint, but use it in ways when it is appropriate and when it will really work. So my question is to start out, why, when we have all the information, some accidentally revealed, some purposely, and some are just on the public record, about what this particular tribe of people who call themselves Jews are up to, their morals, their methods of attaining their ends, and what their ends are, why do we allow it to continue when at the same time we see the evidence of the destructive effect it has on our own tribes, communities, societies, and nations? Why does it continue with nothing done about it? That is the $64 trillion question. Because there are so many of us who see how destructive it is, how bad it is, how rotten it is, and how wrong it is. And yet there seems to be little that we can do except complain, as I'm sort of doing right now. But I'm going to do a little more than this. Well, anyway, this is what we should be talking about, because until we can break through this particular Jewish question, we don't stand a chance of changing a thing. In other words, as long as the Jews are in so much control among us, there's not a thing we're going to be able to do with all of our supposed organizing and so on, because we don't have a voice and we don't have any way of reaching power. So my answer to this question of why is that we have been disabled of our ability to connect the dots. That is, the majority of our people who would share our interests, who are like us and who look like us, they have been disabled. And we've all been disabled to some extent, I think. Every one of us. In order to see what we are socially programmed not to see. This is similar to a lobotomy, really, although it's not physical. It's not a physical disability, but it's a psychological one. It can also be described as the case of the emperor has no clothes, which is a brilliant example of group or mass denial. If everyone around you in a social gathering says that chair is blue, when to your eyes it is red, you doubt your own conclusions and or are just uncomfortable to be different from the rest. So much is in just wanting to be comfortable. You know, we all want to be comfortable. Why? We're not going to go out of our way to make ourselves uncomfortable, which is why we so seldom speak up, because that's what's going to be the result of it. So this is what we're dealing with, and the answer is to break through the comfort zone and break through the political correctness and point out what is actually happening and why. This entails actually lifting our arms and using our index finger to point. We've been taught that this is really bad taste. It's crude, or it's wrong in some way to point out anyone's failings, even if they result in harm to ourselves. Many people actually think we should just mind our own business and or let God or the authorities take care of it. Now, I have to laugh at that because, you know, I think that's really a good one in the disabling department. That works great in disabling us against standing up for our own interests that that somebody else will take care of it. It's not our business. And particularly that God is going to take care of it. And we'll just wait and let him do it. In fact, these are ways that we have been put into denial and not connecting the dots. And so it is these very ideas we have to revolt against and reverse. Again, break the taboo, criticize the Jew. So many like to talk about revolution of the type, you know, with guns and violence and so on. When people who are still behaving politically correct in so many ways talk like this, you know, I just start to despise these people. I really do. It irritates me because to hear them talk this way, because so many people are just dealing with their feelings, dealing with their discomfort by saying, when the revolution comes, you know, as though they're doing it and it's going to come and then we'll solve all these problems. When they're not even out of their political correctness yet. And if they need to have a revolution, they need to have a revolution in their own mind first. We need to do that first to free ourselves of these disabilities that, you know, I've pointed out. We need guns for self-defense, but we're not going to manage to use guns for any other purpose, particularly if we haven't disabled our, you know, freed ourselves from this disabling fear of being unkind to any living soul, because that is God's job to judge everyone's heart and stuff like that. I'm not talking against God. I am saying that I don't think we should pawn everything off. There's a lot of people who pawn everything off on God in order to get back into their comfort zone where it's not up to them. If it were God's job to do all this, well, we'd have to conclude that God is not doing his job. But I think that with these people, fear of an alleged judgment day is maybe their main fear, because they're so afraid that on judgment day they're going to be found as having done something wrong, they're not going to be found favorable in the eyes of the judge, that they prefer not to do very much. And this is, you know, it's all adds to the problem that we have. And in all honesty, it's very selfish, because it's a form of looking out for number one. You know, when you're doing that, you're saying, I'm concerned with my salvation, and so I'm concerned with me, and that comes first. And you feel very holy in saying that, but it's not, you're not standing up. You're not defending your people. And so I don't think that is an attitude that should be encouraged. So all these things are things that go through my mind. But to get back to the main question for tonight, I pose it as, is there a Jewish world plan, as the protocols say? And my answer is yes, there has to be. There has to be one, because we see it in action. We see it being played out. The Jewish idea in the minds of the Jews is that they must be in control of everything, or as much as possible, to secure their existence, and not only their existence, but to thrive and prosper and rule. Not only to exist, but to thrive and prosper and rule. I don't think they are satisfied to rule from behind the scenes forever. They're hardly behind the scenes anymore, as they used to be. That's their method. That's not their final objective, as some people argue, that they don't want to be out front running things, because then they might fail and they'd be blamed for it. I don't think that's the way they're thinking. But many, many non-Jewish people have recognized this Jewish world plan in the protocols of learned elders of Zion. In spite of the fact that they are so, that, you know, it is so, it has proliferated, the idea that it's a forgery, that they're a forgery, has proliferated so much, still, it doesn't convince many, many people. who are not moved by that and who have recognized that this is a world plan that one sees being put in action. And so for that reason, Jews around the world are united in branding these documents as a slander, as something made up by anti-Semites and not written by Jews. They went and they have continued to go all out to belittle the protocols as nonsense created by inferior minds. This is their favorite way of attacking protocols, is to talk about how inferior it is. And in fact, this is one of the methods that Jews use always to defend what they're trying to defend and to distract us away from looking at what they're doing and good criticism of them. They ridicule it. So, for example, I ran across a book review that was in the Jerusalem Post on November 1st, and it featured a negative review of Umberto Eco's latest novel, The Prague Cemetery. I think it's been out about a year. I haven't read it, but I read this review, and I'm going to read it to you, part of it here, the part that in which is most effective for this program. He says, the reviewer says, Umberto Eco's latest novel turns out not quite a treat. But the nice touches can't quite make up for the perfunctory characterizations, the repetitive actions, and above all, the mind-numbing and utterly predictable litany of libels against Jews. Indeed, not long ago, I read for the first time, and I trust for the last time, the actual protocols of the Elders of Zion, and found it at once profoundly stupid and stupefyingly dull. Of course, this reviewer in the Jerusalem Post is a Jew. He goes on, Eco's anti-Semitic scribes, like their real-life counterparts, tend to babble. I don't deny the damage they did, and still do. I simply state that unless the reader is already predisposed to paranoia, their babblings rather quickly become uninteresting. Well, here we have, you know, not only uninteresting, but babblings, paranoia, stupefyingly dull, stupid, mind-numbing, and predictable, among other things here and by this reviewer. Now, Eco's point in detailing, he goes on still, I'm not done with him yet. He says, Eco's point in detailing all this blather surely isn't that anti-Semitic polemicists are a bunch of wackos. We never doubted that. Was it to alert us to the fact that such rantings are still with us? Anyone with an internet connection knows that as well. Well, to give you an idea what this book is about, actually, the book description reads as follows. 19th century Europe, from Turin to Prague to Paris, abounds with the ghastly and the mysterious. Jesuits plot against Freemasons. Italian Republicans strangle priests with their own intestines. French criminals plan bombings by day and celebrate black masses at night. Every nation has its own secret service, perpetrating forgeries, plots, and massacres. Conspiracies rule history. From the unification of Italy to the Paris Commune, to the Dreyfus Affair, to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, Europe is in tumult, and everyone needs a scapegoat. But what if, behind all these conspiracies, both real and imagined, lay one man? Well, you know, he writes these kinds of novels, and his story is somehow one man is the key person in a lot of this stuff that's going on. It's kind of a semi-historical base, you know, based on historical time period novel. But the fact that he writes, Eco, the author, writes a note to readers that's probably in the book that the protocols are a hoax, in his opinion. That's still not good enough for the Jews who don't want any attention to the protocols, unless it is, or any attention to themselves, unless it is to their suffering, their persecutions, or their great achievements. But anything, you know, that brings up questions about what their actual behavior in the world is like, and how they, what their relationship to non-Jewish people is, they don't want to hear it. So even a book like this, they have to put out their reviewers who absolutely tear into it. And mainly, rather than get all excited about it, they just try to make you think that it's not worth reading. It's so dull. It's so stupid. It's stupefyingly dull. So don't bother reading it. That's how they talk about the protocols themselves. Don't bother reading them. That is also the way they talk about everything that they're against, that they feel doesn't put them in the kind of light they want to be in. And they want to snuff it out, and they want to, if they can't censor it altogether, or they can't put people in prison for reading it, then they will try to make out that it's not worth reading, it's no good, and you shouldn't waste your time. And if you do read it, or if you do like it, then, you know, you must be a little stupid. So while mainstream writers, journalists, and politicians have to bow to the Jewish line on the protocols, and they do, as we know, I'm talking about just about all writers, journalists, and politicians. Well, everywhere you look, it is proclaimed without any doubt, any question, any other side shown that the protocols are a forgery, that they're just dumb stuff made up. And they do the same, as you should be aware of, with the Holocaust. And there's a lot of similarity between, not between the protocols and the Holocaust, but between the way they handle the protocols and the way they handle Holocaust denial. These are two very big areas or items that the Jews don't like at all and want to get rid of, because they're both potentially very damaging to Jews. But in spite of this politically correct thinking that most fall into, there are heretics who question the stance and the politically correct stance, and are researching this complicated issue in order to find at least that the so-called proof of the forgery is not solid at all. That's the least thing that we can say, and that I've said before, that this proof that they say they've been proved a forgery is not true, and that is not solid. I've already mentioned Peter Myers, an Australian researcher who has written extensively about the protocols. And his position is basically to defend the authenticity of the protocols. He doesn't come up with anything for sure, because the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, no one has been able to come up with either an author or a place where they were written, or a time where they were written, where it was written, or anything definite on either side of this question. That has not, which is kind of strange, very strange, because you would think that if this document was a forgery, as most forgeries, it has been discovered who created it. But this one, no, it hasn't been. So, but Myers just takes a position that he comes down on the balance that he doesn't think that it's a hoax or a forgery. He thinks it's authentic, but doesn't know by whom, or maybe even in what way. I mean, if it's authentically, if it means it's by Jews, or if it's just authentically written by someone who is serious about it. I don't know what he means by that exactly, but I think he means that it was, he thinks that it actually is a document that was put together by Jews. And now, though, I've come across another of these heretics, and that is a man who goes by the name of Carl Rattle, and I've I came across his six-part essay, which he wrote, I think, a little over a year ago or what? No. I think it came out just in November or something like that. I went through the whole thing, took a bunch of notes, but I'm not going to use that because it's just too much. I can't fit it in. But, you know, my memory is such anymore that little things like that are exactly what I forget and get mixed up on. Like, when did he write this? But, I think it was just, I think he just came out with it a short time ago. And, but he runs a blog called Semitic Controversies, which is the worst behaving blog I've ever come across. I don't know why he has a blog like that. And Carl Rattle is a pseudonym. That's not his real name. I don't know what his real name is. And I find a lot of, disagreement with him or problem with him. I don't know. He doesn't appeal to me much. But in this case, he has done a lot of research, it seems. And I'm kind of surprised that he has done it on this topic, but he has. And, he argues with a lot of detail for a Jewish source of the protocols also. And as coming out of Russia, he thinks that they were found during the Kissinet. Well, I shouldn't say he thinks, he speculates. You know, everybody is speculating about it. And so, he goes through all these reasons why, and he comes down to, this idea he has, which he favors, as best you could say about it, that the protocols were found during the Kishinev, ghetto pogrom in Ukrainian Russia in 1903. This is a famous, pogrom Kishinev, spelled K-H-I-S-I-N-E-V, that is well known, which quite a few Jews actually were killed in it, and they burned down a lot of their houses. So Rattle thinks that while this was going on, somebody in one of the buildings there in the ghetto found this document, and that's where it came from, although he doesn't have any proof of that. But he likes the date, which fits everything well. He likes the date 1903. This took place in 1903, and he thinks that's just perfect. Or the fact that it was first published in 1903 in a newspaper, and then it was published by somebody else, and then it was put into a couple people's books, one of which was Sergei Nilus, the one that we're most familiar with, and that came out in 1905. So he thinks that this fits, and he likes the idea that it was put together in Russia because of all the Zionists there and the political ferment that was going on in Russia at that time. And that this was something that had to do with Zionism and Zionists, which I have a little problem. I have a problem with that and with what he said, but it was interesting. Now, I have a note here. I want to mention that this date, 1903, also fits the mention of a Panama, which came up in the International Jew reading with Hattie Scott and myself. At least what I thought earlier, I thought that it had to be after 1901 to have this mention of a Panama, which relates to the Panama scandal, which became. But then I found out today by really studying that Panama scandal that it became public in 1892 when over 500 French members of parliament, including six ministers, were charged with accepting bribes to withhold information about the financial condition of the Panama Canal Company. And a French Jew of German origin, this is just kind of interesting, Baron Reinach was the financial advisor to the Canal Company, and he and another Jew, Cornelius Hertz, H-E-R-Z, were in charge of distributing the bribe money. So, and part of what was shown to the public by this scandal was that the middlemen between the business sector and the state were almost exclusively Jews. So this was something in which, which was very well known, but it was earlier than what I had thought, because George Clemenceau was defeated in the 1893 election because of his association with Cornelius Hertz, who I mentioned, one of the Jews, and therefore. This would fit with an 1894 or 1895 discovery of the protocols document better than the 1903, if you want to say that they were made public immediately. The 1894-95 fits with Justine Glinka discovery and of them being found in France and, you know, then being sent to Russia and translated and so on. That was just something I thought I'd mention, because before on the International Jew, I'd say, well, gee, this Panama mention here is kind of messes up the idea that that they could have been known before 1901 or 1902. But that's not so. So, first, I want to discuss here some speculation of my own that I find very intriguing and that still revolves around Adolf Cremieux. I can't believe it's already a half hour gone in this show. I hope I can get to everything. The prominent French Jew and Freemason who died in 1880 and the Alliance Israelite Universelle that he founded. I went into quite a bit of detail about Cremieux in a recent Heretics Hour show on November 19th, describing his liberalism and asking, could he be the author of the protocols, or could he have had something to do with them anyway? So I'm not going to repeat any of that today. I'm going to talk about and I'm going to say a few things here about the dispute that's going on, which the main dispute now seems to be whether they originated in France or in Russia and how much they are connected with Zionism. That's something that I see that I didn't see before, because there's a lot of people who want to think that they originated in Russia and not in France, whereas I'm still partial to the idea that they were written in France and that Cremieux very likely had something to do with them, and this is what I'm going to go through in the beginning tonight, because there were two movements in Jewry at the time, the way I see it, the international network of the diaspora, including the very important financial cooperation, that is all the Jewish banking houses and so on, and all that money in Jewish hands in various capitals of the world, which all cooperated in this international Jewish network. And then on the other hand, the Zionist movement that's wanted to move Jews to their own homeland and create a legal state in Palestine, that they wanted to gather all the Jews together in one place and have a state. And these two things seem to be very, you know, have somewhat at odds with one another. They seem to be opposed, but really, they could have been part of the same plan of the learned elders. Or, so the question is, did they have different aims right from the beginning? They may have had. I think they may have had different aims right from the beginning, but eventually could have merged together into what we have now, into a sort of two-pronged approach for the same goal, which is Jewish supremacy. Now, Cremieux and the Alliance Israelite Universelle are on one course, a European one, and then Theodor Herzl's Zionism, which came out of Russia and the Pan-Slavic movement, was on a different course. And Herzl, of course, I don't know. I shouldn't say of course, because this is something I didn't know until I just recently read it, was of Serbian origin. He was born in Budapest in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire in 1860. Now, Cremieux was born, as I said before, as Isaac Moise, M-O-I-S-E, in Nîmes, France, to a wealthy Jewish family in 1796. So that's 65 years earlier than Herzl, like two generations before Herzl was born. You know, I don't know where he got the name Prim Yu, but it doesn't show up anywhere as him, as his being part of his family name. Anyway, he became, as we know, a brilliant lawyer. He became highly respected in Paris. He moved to Paris and, you know, after his schooling and so on. And he was a tireless worker for pro-Jewish causes, similar to the type of Jew that Moses Montefiore was in England. And indeed, these two men worked together. They were of the same generation, close, and they were active at the same time. Moses Montefiore was, his family came from Italy. He originated in Italy, but his parents, I believe it was his parents, that emigrated to England. And I think he was born there, but I can't be sure. I didn't recheck that. If he wasn't born in England, he was there as a child. And he's very, you know, very much an English Jew. And he was very assimilated and fit in and was, you know, became acceptable. In fact, even became knighted and was known as Sir Moses Montefiore. So he was one of those, and friends. Actually, he was close to the Rothschilds because he married their daughter, one of the daughters. He married into the family, and he was also a banker, and, you know, it just fit right in. So he was in the Rothschild clan. And Prim Yu was the same in France. He was very assimilated. He was respected. He fit in, and he was part of the, you know, political scene. He was friends with the close to the Napoleon, the Bonaparte family, and supported the Bonapartes until he had that break with Napoleon III, which I talked about in that previous show. I will remind you once again that was on Heretics Hour, November November 19th. If you want to go back and listen to it. Now, let's see where I am. Now, the thing about Adolf Prim Yu was that he held the post. He was such an important Jew in France, probably the most illustrious Jew in France during the time of his adult life. And he held the post of vice president of the Central Consistory of the Jews of France, which was founded in 1834 and was the administrative agency for all French Jews and was set up under Napoleon. And he held that position for almost 40 years, you know, and so I'm sure he could have been the president if he wanted, but he probably didn't want to. So he agreed to be vice president, but he was a mainstay in that all his life. But more important, I think, is that he founded the AIU, the Alliance Israelite Universelle, in 1860, 20 years before his death, and he became its president 4 years later and remained until his death 11 years later. So once he became president, he stayed in there. And that was a very important and, I think, pivotal organization in the history of the Jewish World Plan. Now, the purpose of the AIU was to join Jews all over the world in a conscious bond as one people, one nation, although scattered and living in many nations. I think that was the idea, that there was no idea whatsoever to join all the Jews in one place like as in Zionism. It was to simply make them aware of that they were Jews and that they should, even though they were living in all these other nations, which was really beneficial to the Jews as a whole, to have people everywhere, they should remember that they're Jews, and they should have this loyalty to their brethren, as they're always calling themselves, and join together in this cause that the AIU represented and help Jews, help Jewish causes everywhere. So they were to benefit Jews wherever they may be, and to defend the interests of Jews who were being persecuted. And this was brought out in the open for the first time, that they, that the Jews were a nation that should stand together and defend each other's, defend the interests of other Jews. Wikipedia says of the AIU that it promotes the ideals of Jewish self-defense and self-sufficiency. Self-defense is a big, big part of why the AIU was created, because, and that's where we're going to tie in with the Damascus affair. But it was created because they now thought that they needed an organization that would go out and defend, or that would be powerful enough to defend Jews wherever they might be if they were under attack, being persecuted, or being accused of things, being accused of crimes, really, which many probably they were committing. But since Jews are never going to admit that they have committed crimes, or that Jews should never, ever be punished for anything, even if they might have done it, because, of course, in their religion, which it says here, you know, here, which it says that that if whatever they do to a non-Jew doesn't count, so they need to be defended and never be found guilty if it can be helped. Of course, in the case of Bernie Madoff, it couldn't be helped, and then he was too far gone, and then of course he was also took advantage of Jews, which is something you're not supposed to do. But the motto of the AIU was translated into English, all Jews bear responsibility for one another. So you can see it's very tribal in outlook. And for the attainment of its objectives, the society proposed to carry on a campaign of education through the press, that is journalism, that was, you know, one of their big methods, and by the publication of works on the history and life of the Jews. This is from Wiki. Then I've got some stuff from the Alliance website itself, which is in French, and I used a Google translated page to read it, but it's pretty good. You know, it's amazing. It's pretty good. Sometimes they're really bad, but this one seems to be pretty good, so I think the correct information from it. So, but you know, this idea of that the AIU focuses on education and on publishing the history and life of the Jews. Well, that is to give their own version, to give the narrative they want on what the history of the Jews is, and on how Jews are, who Jews are, how they behave, what they do, what they think, and so on. They want that all to be from themselves. They don't want other people talking. They don't want non-Jews talking about Jews. And you know how they try to stop people from listening to non-Jews talking about Jews, and always call it anti-Semitism, because they want to be the only ones who can talk about Jews. That's one of the big things that we know about the Jewish world plan. Now, the Alliance, Israelite Universelle, was officially founded by six Jews, and this is from their own website, but in reality was founded by Adolf Premieu, and I'll tell you why he wasn't among the founders in the beginning after I talk about these six men. They were Charles Netter, the son of a long line of rabbis, himself a wealthy businessman. He was probably the number one after Premieu. Levin Narcisse, N-A-R-C-I-S-S-E, he was a lawyer and a collaborator with Premieu, and active in various charities. Now, you know, the AIU would be considered a charity. You know that everything that the Jews, every Jewish organization is considered a charity, I would say. Even all these Holocaust education organizations that they have since the war are called charities. And, of course, then they're all tax deductible and are not, you know, they're not taxed and so on. But to go on, the third one is Isidore Cahen, C-A-H-E-N, a former student of the teacher's school and professor of philosophy, and a supporter of the principle of separation of church and state. That's important to the Jews, you know, to separate church and state, because all these nations were Christian and they wanted to break into that. Eugene Manuel, or Manuel, was a poet and a man of letters. And Aristide Astruc was a rabbi of Portuguese descent, who was an outspoken opponent of the excesses of assimilation. So this member was concerned with not allowing assimilation to go too far. And Jules Carvalho, who was a railway pioneer and engineer and president of a newspaper. These six men wrote The Call of the Alliance. And it's interesting what this was, which was the first, or you might say the first text of this new institution, the founding text. They wrote, gather, this might not be all of it, it might just be part of it. I'm not sure. This is all they had on there. Gather all generous hearts to fight against hatred and prejudice, creating a society of young Jewish activists and idealists who feel solidarity with those who suffer from their condition of Jews or those who are victims of prejudice, regardless of their religion. So right already they're fighting. They present themselves as fighting against hatred and prejudice. That has never changed. You know, they have always presented themselves that way. They are the haters and they are the prejudiced ones, but they turn it around and always say, you know, our fight is against hatred and prejudice. And they want young Jews and activists and idealists who will feel solidarity for Jews who are less well off than the Jews of Europe, you know, because they're reaching out to Jews all over the world, the ones who are, as I said, not so well off. And so the youth are usually more ready to do that. And of course, they want to bring youth, the young Jews, into this movement. They say that, after that, they say, finally, make that culture override the ignorance of a few fanatics. You know, make it so that culture overrides the ignorance of a few fanatics for the good of all. If you think it would be an honor for your religion, again, they're appealing to people as Jews and using religion calling themselves a religion. A lesson for the people, progress for humanity. Always again, there's that humanity. Jews are always using the word humanity, and all their organizations do that. You know, Elie Wiesel's calls his thing the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity. What is a foundation for humanity? I've often asked that question. But, you know, they don't care. They just want to use that word humanity to cover up for the fact that they're really only interested in themselves and in the Jews. They do all this for the good of Jews, not for humanity, but they talk about it differently, and they like to use the word progress. And go on, that's a triumph for truth and universal reason. Again, another key word that they like to use, universal, of course, it's always universal, and they like to say that reason, because that stands against other people's religions, not their religion, but it stands against the religions they want to attack, and they say to see concentrated all the forces of Judaism, small in numbers, big in love and goodwill, come to us, we build the Alliance Israelite Universelle. That was their call of the Alliance. And, you know, it doesn't sound different at all from the protocols. When people who say that the that the wording of the protocols is not the way that Jews think or talk or have ever talked. It's not true. It is the same way. This is the way, of course, this is where they're putting out, they're not being honest. They're not saying we're going to tell these people this and get them to, you know, believe this and do this and that. They're not saying that here. They're putting it out as if they're serious about it and they really care and so on. Now, the website continues, this about Krimyu. There is, of course, a notable absentee, Adolf Krimyu, deeply shaken by the recent conversion to Catholicism of his children at the initiative of his wife. The Nimes lawyer, real instigator of the founding of the AIU, did not want to appear at the forefront of those who launched the project. But 3 years later, in 1863, he would be elected president of the institution. Well, this is written on their own website, so while I didn't find anything about it anywhere else, they say that his children were converted to Catholicism at the initiative of his wife. He was very close to his wife. He died a few months after his wife died, and it was said that they had both said neither one could live without the other. And in the genealogy, Krimyu has only one daughter and one son, and they each of them in turn married and had one daughter only. So it's not like a big family or anything. And these two children, and Gustav was the son. He died at the age of 40 for whatever reason, and the girl lived until 77. But nothing is said about this conversion to Catholicism. But there is a story that I came across that might explain it, but I don't want to go into it because it takes too much time. So I'm going to move on with the fact that the AIU calls itself one of the main international organizations in the field of Jewish culture and education. Its objective is the dissemination of Judaism. This is what it says about itself: the dissemination of Judaism in the tradition of tolerance and openness to the modern world. So they talk a lot about ethics, the ethical responsibility. I see that same thing in Elie Wiesel again. He's big on ethics. In fact, has his essay on ethics that he promotes and gets a lot of newspaper attention by doing that. So the Jews like to present themselves as being the ethical people. And also they focus on the fight for equal rights, which they say is not only for Jews but for all religious minorities, which makes the world better for themselves and easier. And then under the banner of protecting minority rights, they won a victory in 1878 with the adoption by England, France, and Germany, in which they, at a conference following the end of the war in 1877, and these countries, England, France, and Germany, agreed to this, which the Jews wanted to push this through, which read, the distinction between religious beliefs and faiths cannot be alleged against any person as a ground for exclusion or disability in the enjoyment of civil and political rights, admission to public employments, functions and honors, or the exercise of professions and industries in any locality whatsoever. Freedom and practice outside of all cults are guaranteed to the nationals as well as foreigners, and no hindrance shall be offered either to the hierarchical organization of different faiths or to their relations with their spiritual chiefs. In other words, this encapsulates what they're trying to create, this creates the emancipation in these countries for foreigners, for whoever comes, whoever is in the country, enjoys this kind of equality, They can't be discriminated against on grounds of their religious beliefs or any cult that they belong to, and nor in public employment and the honors and functions that are available or in whatever profession they want to engage in, or any industry they want to engage in or work in. So this is the this is right there the goal that was going on at that time in Europe for the Jews to be released from so many situations in which they could be accused of things, and they could be kept out, and they could be kept apart and not given all the rights that the nationals had, which was a big mistake. But in the euphoria of following a war, you know, everybody was feeling great, so that's when they pushed it through. Well, I'm already at the halfway point here, ladies and gentlemen. When I come back in the second half, I'm going to be talking about René Cassin, who was the president of the AIU from 1943 to 1976, and was also a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And I'm going to be talking about, I don't have time to talk about Stephane Hessel. Maybe I will talk about his crazy story another time. But I will start in with Cassin and a little bit more about that, and then I will be going right on to the Damascus affair and how it led to the protocols being written, and many people think so too. So that's what we'll do when we get back. So stay with me. It will probably get more interesting from here on. It's a lot of material to take in, you know, I know that, but I think we need to know it.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an die wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Sie erzählt von einer Zeit, für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich. Und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. You're listening to the Heretics Hour on December 10th, 2012. And I want to get right back into it because I have a lot to cover yet. I didn't get as far in the first half as I thought I would. So I want to start with, but I do want to mention this man named René Cassin, who is also, well, interesting in showing what is going on with this Alliance Israelite Universel, who he became a president of this organization in 1943 while the war was still going on, and he remained president till 1976, where he may have died at that time, but he was a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1968. He was very active in peace and human rights and so on, and liberal causes, and he was one of the founders of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in 1948. Other founders of this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is still a part of the UN, were John Peters Humphrey, who was more active. He was kind of the mentor, or I don't know if he was a mentor, but he was somebody that René Cassin worked with. He was from Canada. René Cassin is a French, and there was this Stéphane Hessel, who I found out some very interesting things about, but I can't go into that now. He was also from France. And P.C. Chang from China, Charles Malik from Lebanon, and Eleanor Roosevelt from the United States. Eleanor Roosevelt was actually the chairman or the head or whatever of this committee that wrote up the Universal Declaration. And naturally, if she was in charge of it, the UN was going to accept it, right? Well, it was in 1945 that Cassin joined with the AIU. How can that be? Because it says up here that he was president from 1943. Well, somebody wrote this wrong. It was in 1945 that he joined with that the AIU joined with the American Jewish Committee and the Anglo-Jewish Association, these three organizations, and founded something called the Consultative Council of Jewish Organizations, which was dedicated to providing encouragement from a Jewish perspective to the nascent UN human rights system. Well, you know, you can figure how that works. They wanted to get the Jewish perspective into the UN And of course they did. And it says of Rene Cassin that as the head of the AIU, he pursued civil rights for the Jews and was an active Zionist. Civil rights for the Jews, it's always for the Jews, at least they admit it here, and an active Zionist. So it, by now, the idea of a universal association of Jews from around the world has kind of merged with Zionism. Zionism is now perfectly acceptable, whereas in the beginning, a lot of Jews like Rothschilds and other prominent Jews, banking Jews and so on, were not interested in Zionism. They weren't supporters of Zionism, but it got to be so popular. I mean, Herzl did an excellent job of getting it going, and the Jews were, Eastern European Jews especially, and the Eastern Jews were such huge supporters and so engaged in Zionism that finally everyone went along with it. And now that it's all kind of one big thing, whereas, in my opinion, they want to have both. They want to have their state in Israel and a Zionist state and Zionist philosophy, and they want to have Jews, a Jewish network all over the world, in every country, working together for Jewish interests. They want both of that, and they've got it right now. So now, prior to the Damascus affair, I have to mention this well-known letter to supposedly to the chief rabbi of Spain from the Grand Sanhedrin in Constantinople. At the time, this was in the 15th century, at the end of the 15th century, supposedly. In fact, I think some of this is written a little wrong, but you know, it's hard to find anything on this letter. Actually, when I looked for it, I thought I'd find quite a bit, and there wasn't anything, which is why I now am of the opinion that it's not authentic. It actually comes from the book Waters Flowing Eastward. You know, in case some of you aren't familiar with it, excuse me, this is the one in which Jews in Spain were under having a lot of difficulty because they were being told they have to become Christian or they're going to be expelled. The only way they can avoid being expelled from Spain is to convert to Christianity. And then there was a lot of suspicion whether they were converting sincerely or not. And the advice was asked from the Grand Sanhedrin in Constantinople, and they got this advice back, you know, that, well, if they say you have to do that, become Christians. And then as you're Christians, you know, work against the Christians while you're, you know, inside Christianity. And if they want to take your property, well, make your sons merchants, so that you can take theirs, and make your sons doctors so you can, you know, take away their lot, Christians' lives, and make your sons canons and clerics in the Christian church so that you can destroy their churches and things like that. Which sounds, you know, reasonable enough, knowing the way we know the way that the Jewish religion works and the way they think about Christians in our societies. But still, story, I didn't know this, but it apparently originated in this book, Waters Flowing Eastward, by L. Fry, now known as Paquita de Shishmaref, which I was seen some other things from this book, and now I don't trust this book. I never read it. I always intended to, and I know it's a classic and highly thought of, and probably I should read it, but I don't know how I can get around to books. And, you know, it turns out that when I don't read books, what I have found is that so many of the books that that I thought I really want to read, but I never got around to it, never could get around to it, turn out, I finally find out that they're not that good. And I'm kind of glad I never read it, because I would have gotten a lot of stuff that I think this woman lived in Russia. She was not Russian herself, but she must have married a Russian. And she was in Russia. She wrote this about the protocols and her, the things, a lot of what she says about the protocols and how they're written and when and who and so on, I can't agree with. So I think that I don't agree with this book at all. But it, so that's, I will say that I found a, because some of you might be pretty interested in this, you know, it was this thing that was sent was signed Prince of the Jews of Constantinople. No name. That's always suspicious. And then I found a PDF of A History of the Inquisition of Spain, Volume 1 by Henry Charles Lea, L-E-A. And in chapter 3, The Jews and the Conversos, and I'll link to this in the program page. There's a section that says this. Here, and this seems like a pretty scholarly, lots of footnotes, but, you know, it's long. I mean, detailed, my God. This is chapter 3 already, and these are long chapters, and they're only talking about the 1400s in this history of Spain. So, well, it's the history of the Inquisition of Spain, but still, it's incredible. It seems like it covers everything that ever could have happened. So here on this page, they say, here we may presumably refer to the, no, I don't know if they left out too, the fabrication of a correspondence discovered. Now they use the word fabrication, a fabricated correspondence discovered 50 years later among the archives of Toledo by Archbishop Silicio between Chamorro, Prince of the Jews of Spain, and Yulif, Prince of those of Constantinople, in which the latter, replying to a request for counsel, tells the former, as the king takes your property, make your sons merchants, that they may take the property of the Christians. As he takes your lives, make your sons physicians and apothecaries, that they may take Christian lives. As he destroys your synagogues, make your sons ecclesiastics, and so on. But he doesn't use this as a real event. He says it's a fabrication. And then it has a footnote 148, and the footnote reads, a Revista de España CVI and a number says this correspondence was long used as a weapon against the new Christians. And see, you know, it refers to another book or article in Spanish, or a couple of them maybe. Anyway, meaning, I take this to mean it was used as a weapon against the new Christians. That means they used this fabricated correspondence. It was fabricated as against those who wanted to become Christians, against converts. To be suspicious of converts, that they might be trying to join the church for, you know, nefarious reasons and wanting to undermine the church in doing so and so on. But that's what I found out about that interesting bit of communication that is used so much and comes from the book Waters Flowing Eastward, sorry. Okay, now, what was behind, asking the question, what was behind the creation of the Alliance Israelite Universelle, which I think is very important because it was the first organization that began this universal Jewish connections and networking in the modern sense. And the answer to that is the Damascus Affair in 1840. The AIU was created in 1860, 20 years later. But still, this Damascus Affair is, and what came from that is what is thought by many to have led to such big changes in the Jewish program and what we can call, what the International Jew calls the Jewish World Plan, or the Jewish plan for world dominance, whatever. Okay, in a, now here we have this letter. Now this I think is, this is real. This is a letter, another letter from the elders of the Hebrew community in Constantinople. And it was addressed to Messrs. De Rothschild in London, the London Rothschild family. More than one Rothschild is there, any of the Rothschilds there, I guess. Dated March 27th, 1840. And I'm going to read it as fast as I can here because it's really interesting in the way that they write this stuff and how, as it goes along, they are exaggerating, I think, probably, the sufferings of the Jews and what's being done to them and giving their own story out. But, of course, these are the representatives of the Jewish community in Constantinople sending out kind of an SOS to the Rothschilds in London, asking for help. And maybe they say, independently of the tie which so strongly binds together the whole Jewish community, of which you, gentlemen, are distinguished ornaments, have always been prominent in assisting our distressed brethren, always brethren, whose appeals to you are not infrequent. I guess they're always being appealed to, the Rothschilds. Your hearts cannot but be greatly to sympathize with two Jewish communities, that of Damascus under the Egyptian jurisdiction. Well, this is not written by him. This is added. And that of Rhodes. They're going to mention both Damascus and Rhodes. Continuing, oppressed by the tyrannies of the pashas who govern them. This was in the Ottoman Empire under Islamic rule. Okay. Goes on. These persecutions originated in calumnies which the oppressors themselves have invented and which have been long rankling in their hearts to the prejudice of the Jewish community. Our brethren are accused of being accomplices in murder in order to make their Passover cakes with the blood of the murdered men, a thing in itself incredible as being forbidden in our holy religion. This report has, however, found credence with the governing pashas of Damascus and Rhodes, and they have oppressed and incarcerated not only several old men and rabbins, but even a number of children, putting them to tortures, of which it makes men shudder to hear. Such is the afflicting picture drawn in the letters of our persecuted brethren, of which, with deep regret, we hand you copies. Now, in writing this, they knew that this was going to be made public. They didn't write this as a secret letter to other Jews in London and wanting to get some help. They wrote this in the style of what they wanted to put out, how they wanted to publicize themselves, their plight, what they go through, and their version of what was happening. Now, he goes on to talk about, I'm going to skip some of this. He goes on to talk about how terrible are their persecutions, and they cannot find any way of salvation because nobody will listen to them, and their unhappy brethren are languishing in chains and in prison so as to obtain from the Pasha of Egypt the liberation of the Jews of Damascus. They entreat the Rothschilds to interpose their valuable mediation in this matter to help their brethren. And of course, these are the ones who were accused of blood libel in the death of the monk or the priest, the Christian priest, and the disappearance of this priest. But they mention it further on, so I'll let you get it from that. Then they say, we, the rabbins and elders of this place, impressed with the urgency of the case and moved by compassion for our brethren and further induced by the report which is current throughout the world of the generous and philanthropic sentiments which animate you and fill your hearts, ever open to the miseries of the oppressed, feel persuaded that you will exert yourselves to do all you possibly can in these distressing circumstances. And it's signed by I. Camando Samuel de Entreves. But then they wrote another letter to to Abraham Conorte and Aaron Cohen, the Jews of Damascus did, elders of the congregation at Constantinople. And here they go into a lot more detail, and they say that that there was a murder, and the Jewish community were calumniated for it, and they're going to repeat everything as it happened in detail, and it is this. On Wednesday, the first day of the month of February, there disappeared from Damascus a priest who with his servant had dwelt for 40 years in the city. He exercised the profession of physician and visited the houses of Catholics, Jews, and Armenians for the purpose of vaccination. The day following, Thursday, there came people into the Jewish quarter to look for him, saying they had seen both him and his servant in that quarter on the previous day. In order to put into execution their conspiracy, they seized a Jewish, now this is their version, see, they seized a Jewish barber, telling him that he must know all about the matter, and took him to the governor, who on hearing the accusation, now this is again an Islamic in the Ottoman Empire, who on hearing the accusation immediately ordered him to receive 500 stripes. He was also subjected to other cruelties, and he was urged to accuse all the Jews as accomplices, and thinking that by this means to relieve himself, he accused Jews David, Isaac, and Aaron Harari, Joseph Legnacio, Moses Abulafia, Moses Bekar Judah, and Joseph Harari as accomplices, who had offered him 300 piastres to murder the above-mentioned priest, inasmuch as the Passover holidays were approaching and they required blood for their cakes. You know, their, matzah cakes. He said that he did not, however, give ear to their instigations and did not know what had happened to the priest and his servant. So this guy, this barber, told him something that they wanted to know and maybe was the truth, and then said that they wanted him to do this, but he didn't listen to them. He didn't do it. He didn't go out and kill the priest, and he doesn't know what happened to the priest. But he identified these men as wanting to kill the priest. Upon this, the pasha caused the person's name to be arrested as instigators and punished with blows and other torments of the most cruel nature. But as they were innocent, they could not confirm as true that which was a calumny, and therefore, in contradiction, they asserted their innocence, appealing to the sacred writings, which strictly prohibit the Jews from feeding upon any blood, much less that of a fellow creature, a thing totally repugnant to nature. Nevertheless, they were imprisoned with chains round their necks and had daily inflicted on them the most severe beatings and cruelties, and were compelled to stand upright without food of any kind for 50 hours together. Typical lies and exaggerate. Well, that's me. I think this is lies and exaggerations, similar to what Holocaust survivors give us. But it did turn out, at least according to their story, that four of these, that there eventually were 11, there eventually were 9 survivors of this who were freed, but if there were, they say that there were 13 of them altogether by the time it all ended, and 4 of them, and some of them died. So I don't know, but we'll go on here. Subsequently, the Hebrew butchers, that the butchers of Hebrews, were cited to appear as they were put in, the Hebrew butchers, meaning that's what they call them, were cited to appear as they were put in chains together with the rabbins, Jacob and Tebi, Salomon, Harari, and Asario, Jalfon, and they too were beaten to such an extent that their flesh hung on in pieces upon them. And these atrocities were perpetrated in order to induce them to confess that they used blood in making the Passover cakes. They replied that if such had been the case, many Jewish proselytes would have published the fact. This, however, was not sufficient. After this, the same governor went to the boys' college. He had the boys carried to prison, bound them with chains, and forbade the mothers to visit their imprisoned children, to whom only 10 drachmas of bread and a cup of water per day were allowed, the governor expecting that the fathers, for the sake of liberating their children, would confess the truth of the matter. Now, you have to ask yourself whether you think this really took place this way, whether these rulers treated these accused Jews so badly, trying to get a confession out of them, rather than investigate their reports and so on. They want. I doubt it. I really do. So the writer goes on. Subsequently, a Jew who was still at liberty presented himself before the governor, stating that the calumny of our using blood for our Passover cakes had been discussed before all the powers, who, after consulting their divines, had declared the falsehood of the charge. And he added that either others had killed the priest and his servant, or they had clandestinely absented themselves from the country, and that the barber, in order to save himself from persecution, had stated that which was not true. Upon this, the governor replied that as he had accused other persons of killing them, he must know who the murderers were, and in order that he should confess, he was beaten to such an extent that he expired under the blows. So supposedly this man was beaten to death. And this, I think, is said to show how cruel and barbarous the Gentiles are and how the Jews suffer and under false accusations. Going on, after this, the governor, with a body of 600 men, oh, that sounds like too many, proceeded to demolish the houses of his Jewish subjects, hoping to find the bodies of the dead. But not finding anything, he returned and again inflicted on his victims further castigations and torments, some of them too cruel and disgusting to be described. At last, being incapable of bearing further anguish, they said that the charge was true. The governor, hearing this statement, asked them where they had secreted the blood of the murdered men, to which one of them replied that it had been put in a bottle and delivered to Moses Abulafia, who, however, declared he knew nothing of it. In order to make him confess, he received 1,000 stripes, but this infliction not extorting any confession from him, he was subjected to other insupportable tortures, which at length compelled him to declare that the bottle was at home in a chest of drawers. Upon this, the governor ordered him to be carried on the shoulders of 4 men, because he could not walk, that he might open the bureau. This was opened, but nothing was found in it, except a quantity of money which the governor seized, asking at the same time where the blood was. Whereupon Abulafia replied that he made the statement in order that the governor should see the money in the bureau, trusting by this means to escape, like thinking that if the governor got some money, kind of like a bribe. That's all I can make out of that. Upon this, the tortures were again repeated, and Abulafia, to save himself, embraced the Mohammedan religion. In this manner, they treated all the prisoners who have been for 1 month in this misery. In Beirut and in Damascus, the Jews are not permitted to go out. Well, I haven't checked out, I haven't had time to check out other sources to see if this whole situation in Damascus at this time was as bad as what they're saying here, and that the Jews in there were not allowed to leave their area and so on. But I will have to do that. Now, this sounds more and more like a Holocaust survivor story, right? I mean, it gets worse, and it gets even worse from here. It gets, you know, really the tortures that the Jews are experiencing seemingly to me out of exaggerated beyond what they could have been. Anyway, after this, an individual came forward, some individual, and stated that by means of astrology, he had discovered and ascertained that the 7 individuals above named assassinated the priest and that did assassinate the priest, and that the servant was killed by Raphael Farkey, Nathan and Aaron Levy, Mordecai Farkey, and Asher of Lisbon. So now the first of these two men were immediately arrested, and others, it appears, sought safety in flight, the other two. You will judge from this, the elders of Damascus say, that is these letter writers, what sort of justice is administered by means of astrology, and how such justice is exercised. And there is no one who is moved to compassion in favor of the unfortunate victims. Even Bechor Negri, the governor's banker, unable to bear these afflictions, became a Muslim. So the governor had a Jewish banker, and he was one of the one of the accused, and he converted to Islam. I guess if you converted to Islam, you were freed from this. Read this, dearest friends, they continue, to these Jews that they're writing to, Commando, Hateni, and Carmona. The Jews, then he starts talking about the Jews of Rhodes, another situation that took place at the time. The Jews of Rhodes ascribed their state of misery to the elders of the congregation in Constantinople in the following statement. This is another letter from, I guess, or maybe it's from the same writer, but says, a Greek boy, about 10 years old, son of an inhabitant of the country, is said to have been lost, and the Christians have calumniated us by saying that we have killed him. All the European councils came forward to demand an elucidation of the affair. They went in a body, with the exception of the Austrian council, who they think was kind of on their side, on the Jewish side, trying to help the Jews, to the Pasha, and requested that he would entrust to them the conduct of the business, which request the Pasha granted. They then summoned before them two Greek women who dwelt near the city, who stated that I guess these European were the, what we would call, what do we call it? When we have representatives in other countries, you know, we have diplomatic, can't think what they're called, in our embassies. So that's what these would have been, Europeans getting involved in this, the way it seems. And supposedly these Jews say they summoned before them two Greek women who dwelt near the city, who stated that on Tuesday some Jews were passing from the village to the city and that one of them had a Greek boy with him. The consuls immediately cited the Jew to appear before them and questioned him on the subject. He replied that he could prove that during the whole of Tuesday he was in the village and did not come into the city until Wednesday. He added, moreover, that even if this boy did enter the city by that road, and at that time the Jews were going into it, it ought not, therefore, to be believed that the Jews had killed him, as the road was the chief and public thoroughfare through which anyone might pass. Well, that's certainly true. These reasons were not admitted by the consuls, say the Jews, and the unfortunate Jew was immediately put in irons and tortured in a manner never yet seen or heard of. Having been loaded with chains, many stripes were inflicted on him. Red-hot wires were run through his nose, burning bones applied to his head, and a heavy stone was laid upon his breast, so that he was reduced to the point of death. All this time his tormentors were accusing him, saying, "You have stolen this Greek boy to deliver him up to the rabbi. Confess at once if you wish to save yourself." Their object was to calumniate the rabbi and to take vengeance on all the community, and they stated openly that this was done for the purpose of exterminating the Jews in Rhodes or to compel them to change their religion so that they might be able to boast in Europe of having converted an entire community. Well, this shows at least that there was no love for the Jews. I don't know whether this happened in the way they say, if they were treated this badly. But the fact is that there was no love for the Jews. And, you know, why don't the Jews go somewhere else if they're so disliked? But they say their object, no, I did that. Meanwhile, the poor Jew cried out in the midst of these torments, praying for death, to which they replied that he must confess to whom he had given the boy, and then he should be immediately set at liberty. The poor Jew, oppressed by tortures beyond endurance, resorted to falsehood in order to save himself. He calumniated first one and then another, but many whom he accused had been absent from the town some time, which clearly proved that his assertions had no other object than to free himself from these tortures. Nevertheless, all those who could be found were immediately imprisoned and subjected to insupportable torments to extort from them the confession that they had delivered the boy to the chief rabbi or to the elders of the community, and night and day they were tormented because they would not accuse innocent persons. Meanwhile, goaded by continual tortures, these poor creatures cried out and prayed that they might be killed rather than be subjected to such anguish, especially seven of them, who anxiously courted death and indeed were all but dead in consequence of these tortures. And so they entreat the people they're writing to, and they say, okay, now they start accusing the Christians. They say, during the day at such, you must know that during the day at such times as there is no one in the Jewish quarter, the Christians are going about endeavoring clandestinely to leave the dead body of a Turk or Christian in the court of some Jewish house. I find that hard to believe. For the purpose of having the individual brought before the governor in order to give a coloring to their calumny. Such is the misery that weighs upon our hearts and blinds our eyes. We have even been refused the favor of presenting a petition to the Pasha of the city. After 3 days spent in this wretchedness, they refused even to supply us with bread in our quarter, for our families shut up with us. But by dint of entreaty, we have obtained as a favor the supply at high prices of salt fish and black bread. From what we can gather from the Europeans who are about the Pasha, he acts in concert with the councils, that is, those European representatives, as he has done from the beginning. We accept from this the Austrian council, who at first endeavored to protect us, but who was at length compelled to join with the multitude. Well, following this, something... Certainly, the Jews did go all out to do something in both of these places, and they succeeded. And Sir Moses Chaim Montefiore, who I said was married into the Rothschild family, was the head man of this delegation that went to visit the ruler of Syria, Muhammad Ali, although he was in Egypt. He was a ruler of Egypt, which also ruled Syria at the time. And included in that delegation was Britain's Lord Palmerston, well-known name, but I can't exactly identify him right now. And the French lawyer Adolphe Cremieux, who was a major, played a major role in that. And Austrian consul, maybe this is that Austrian consul, Merlato, the missionary John Nicolaisen, and a Solomon monk. And they led this delegation, and they negotiated in Alexandria with the ruler I suppose his officials, supposedly from August 4th to August 28th. And in that, of course, they were backed by the Rothschilds, so what do you think happened? What means did they probably use? Financial pressure. They secured the unconditional release and recognition of innocence of the 9 prisoners that still remained alive out of 13, they say. And later in Constantinople, Montefiore also went to see Sultan Abdulmesid persuaded him to issue a firman or edict intended to halt the spread of blood libel accusations in the Ottoman Empire. This was very important, and he managed to... I read all of that in the diary of Montefiore, but I don't have time to read it to you. But he gave this long, flowery speech to the Sultan, which the Sultan liked, you know, full of praise for the Sultan and so on. And the Sultan agreed to do it. So what they gained here was an edict that there would be no more blood libel accusations against the Jews allowed in the Ottoman Empire. So this was something that the Jews really have feared and have been, you know, upset by, and has been a serious accusation against them, which I think has been true in many cases, if not most, in which they were accused. And we can, well, I won't say that. But, you know, they've gotten it now. And now, you know, this Damascus affair is presented everywhere on the internet. I mean, everywhere. I couldn't find anything other as a false accusation against the Jews, which was false from the start. And all these blood libel accusations against Jews are false. And you don't find any other version unless you really hunt. And now, according, I have a quote, something here from the notorious Daniel Pipes, who is, you know, a notorious Jew. You should know who Daniel Pipes is if you don't look him up. But he has written that the real impact of the Damascus affair lay in Europe, where it led to a formidable backlash against Jews, the greatest in years. Jews found themselves completely unprepared for the tribulations they suffered, but learned from this tragedy to organize and lobby, and from that came the first stirrings of modern Jewish solidarity, the basis of the formidable institutions that followed. And the events encouraged the growth of the modern Jewish press. As a result, a sense of solidarity was evoked among the Jewish communities of Europe they had never experienced before. Thus, the Damascus affair gave birth to modern Jewish press, especially in Western Europe, such as the long-lived papers, Les Archives Israelites de France, which lasted for 95 years, beginning in 1840, a Jewish newspaper type thing, and also the Jewish Chronicle, which was begun in 1841 in London, and is still going. These are the first two long-lived Jewish newspapers in Europe. And what he's saying is that in spite of the fact that they got this blood libel edict in the Ottoman Empire, there's a lot of dislike amongst Europeans that came from this Damascus affair against Jews, probably because they believed at the time that there was truth in it. And I think there was probably truth in it. But you can't find much that's actually written from that time now or anything much. I don't know. I didn't have enough time to really search, probably what's necessary to do. But I believe that a lot of Europeans believed it, and there was a lot of bad feeling against the Jews. And this caused the Jews to say, hey, wait, we better do something about this. And they started then seriously organizing and lobbying and building up their solidarity in order to defend themselves. That's what it's all about. And this is what the International Jew points out, too, that what they're doing is they need to defend themselves. That's why they want to control the press. And they do control the press so that nothing can come out against them that they don't want to come out, to be said against them. And the Damascus affair prompted French Jews to establish the Alliance Israelite Universelle in 1860. This is what was said. And this is not just for me, but this is generally considered to be the truth. And Jonathan Frankel, I want to mention him. He wrote a book called The Damascus Affair. Jonathan Frankel is a Jew. I have something about him. I'll tell you that right now. In his obituary, it said about him. He was raised in a traditional Jewish home with strong Zionist commitments. His devotion to Israel ran deep. It was wedded to an unyielding belief in liberalism. Well, that's just, I just took that part out so you got an idea, because he is Jewish and he's a loyal Jew, and he wrote about the Damascus affair, and so did Daniel Pipes. That's the kind of books you get. I couldn't find, like I said, I couldn't find anything from the other perspective on the Damascus affair at this point. And he wrote in there, neither the Board of Deputies nor the Central, that's the Board of Deputies of Jews in, that might have been the Board of Deputies in France, nor the Central Consistory in France saw themselves as constituted to deal on a systematic or regular basis with foreign affairs, and the eventual result of the constant pressure from so many different crisis points was the establishment in 1860 of the Alliance Israelite Universelle. They were finding that Jews were in trouble all in many different places, and they needed to react to that. They were, you know, Jews are determined to defend and save every Jew, and to not allow Jews to be found guilty of things or to be put in prisons, or, you know, they're always going to defend their brethren because in their mind, Jews are never guilty of anything. So it says, Frankel says, this new organization in which Adolf Kremieu played a key role for many years was specifically established with the aim of channeling support, both diplomatic and educational, from the Jews in the West to those in the more dangerous and less developed regions of the world, particularly in Eastern Europe and the Ottoman Empire. So you can take, I don't need to explain what that meant. So I say that new Jewish nationalist movements emerged after 1881. Western Jews could be counted upon to provide massive aid for these efforts. You know, there are so many rich Western Jews, and for Zionist projects, you know, they provided aid for these. And ironically, the Alliance was pledged to an emancipationist ideology as opposed to Jewish nationalism. You know, I keep repeating this because I think it's true that the two things were different in the beginning. But in the end, Zionism took on a life of its own, and it is yet to be seen where it will lead, maybe nowhere. It's a little bit in trouble in Israel right now, but it remains to be seen. And also a little note, in 1866, while Kremieu was president, still president of the AIU, he, in his early days, he traveled to St. Petersburg to successfully defend the Jews of Saratov, who had been accused in a case of blood libel. And I could not find any details on that. I mean, it's just amazing. Maybe I'm not using the right keywords when I'm putting it in the Google search, so maybe I'm not coming up with anything. But I think a lot of this stuff is being sort of removed, or it's, I don't know how they can do that, but I have to continue on with this and get a better answer to that question. So it's not a stretch at all to go from the Damascus affair to the formation of the AIU in 1860 to the formulation of an overall plan for the final solution to the Jewish problem. That's what I'm calling it now. The world plan of Judaism is their plan for their final solution to their problem, which is to gain control of the mechanisms of power so that all Jews everywhere are safe, no matter what they do. Jews would be safe if they weren't criminals, but since they want to be criminals, they have to gain the mechanisms of power so that they can keep Jews from being, punished for that. I submit that the Jews wouldn't be without a plan, and a written plan for their final solution. That's why I think that one reason why I think that the protocols is can be a real plan of the Jews. And the big failing of the Holocaust arguments is that there's no written plan, right? They say, well, where's the plan? There's no plan for it. And they have no answer to that, because everyone knows that you can't carry out such a huge endeavor without a plan. And at the very least, the French Jews had a plan, which was kept in their lodges. and with the Alliance Israelite Universelle. I believe that they, you know, France was the center of Jewry at that time, European Jewry. France was the center. And there was so much, as I mentioned, as came out in this book by Umberto Eco in the beginning of the program, that his book, The Prague Cemetery, he wrote about this period of time in France and the amazing, you know, stuff that was going on. It was the center of everything. And so, so that's another argument, and something else. I would like to say that the protocols are being revealed to the general public. That the protocols being revealed to the general public is as big a problem to the Jews as is Holocaust denial. I think these are equivalent in damage. They take both of these things as of the utmost seriousness and importance to their cause. To deny the protocols and to promote the Holocaust, you know, we see it, I see it opposite, in the opposite way. But both these things are very damaging and have been damaging. The more the protocols are studied and read and talked about, they hate that. And the more Holocaust denial, which is we starting to use this phrase instead of revisionism, but the more the revisionists get their message out and the more people doubt the Holocaust and what is said to have happened, this is also very damaging to them. And so their reaction is always the same to all these things, to the protocols, Holocaust denial, or, well, these two, because I think these are the two most important. Their first reaction is ridicule and refusal to talk about it. They say it's beneath contempt, you know. It's beneath them, like the, you know, they like Weasel and his, I don't want to be in the same room with a Holocaust denier. And then that woman, I can't think of her name right now, that nobody likes, who says, you know, that you can't debate with the Holocaust denier. There's nothing to debate. You can't debate the Holocaust. There's nothing to debate. So it's all just beneath them and all ridiculous. And they won't even discuss it. Their second reaction is that they work very hard to call it anti-Semitism and hate and to get legal sanctions against it, to put people in prison, to make it illegal to talk about. Of course, Holocaust denial is illegal in many, many countries. Amazing when you think about it. What if they made reading the protocols illegal? Well, it was illegal in Russia for a time, and people were shot on site if they had a copy of it. Now, what if they did? If they managed to get to that extent in Europe, like they've gotten, to be able to imprison people for Holocaust denial? What if they could put you in prison for reading this book? Well, that would cut down on it quite a bit. It really would, because people don't want to take that chance. And then three, they use the media to accept only the Jewish side, which we know, and they. And now they even possibly have perverted the internet because, like I say, I'm having a hard time finding things on the internet that it seems to me, it used to be easy, they were there, but now it's like, where is it? You know, do you have to go to page 14 on the search, you know, the search pages to find something that you're looking for? I don't know. And the fourth is that they pressure governments and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to take the Jewish side also. And they are succeeding in large measure because our people also take their side. And this is what irritates me. Our people take their side, and this must stop. We must take our own side, even if we're not yet convinced that it's correct, but we need to be looking for what's correct, and we should not be so easily convinced that the Jews are right and we are wrong. That shouldn't be done now. In the little bit of time I have left, I want to talk about Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels and what they said about the protocols. And in 1924, in Goebbels' diary, if it's accurate, he said that he believed that the elders, that the protocols were a forgery. Well, that was in 1924, shortly after that was announced, and he was probably influenced by the Times story and what so many people were saying. But in his diary in 1943, you know, he wrote, "I have devoted exhaustive study to the protocols of Zion. In the past, the objection was always made that they were not suited to present-day propaganda. In reading them now, I find that we can use them very well. The protocols of Zion are as modern today as they were when published for the first time." Now, let's see. This is something from NICECOR. I thought it was kind of interesting. NICECOR goes ahead, you know, and when they talk about the protocols of the Elders of Zion and all these Jewish people and writers and sites and so on, they say that it was proved to be a forgery at this trial in Bern, Switzerland in 1935. And they do not go on to ever say that it was that this ruling was completely illegal, and that only the prosecutor's witnesses were heard. They were not, once it was the turn for the defense witnesses, they didn't allow them to be heard and so on. Anyway, this ruling was entirely overturned, completely overturned by a higher court later on. So there's no, you cannot honestly cite that trial in Switzerland as somehow legally proving that the protocols are a forgery. And then we know what, or you should know what Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, a whole paragraph about it, which I don't have here to read, because I'm reading still from Goebbels' diary, and he says, "At noon," this is 1943, "I mentioned this to the Führer. He believed the protocols were absolutely genuine. The Jewish question, in the Führer's opinion, will play a decisive role in England. In all the world," he said, "the Jews are alike. Whether they live in a ghetto of the East or in the bankers' palaces of the city or Wall Street, they will always pursue the same aims and without previous agreement even use the same means. One might well ask, why are there any Jews in the world order? That would be exactly like asking, why are there potato bugs? Nature is dominated by the law of struggle. There will always be parasites who will spur this struggle on and intensify the process of selection between the strong and the weak." Well, I want to add here that he means that one side will prove to be stronger than the other. In every struggle, one side proves to be stronger than the other. And this struggle is always going on because someone will always challenge you if you have a preeminent position. So Goebbels goes on, "The principle of struggle dominates also in human life. One must merely know the laws of this struggle to be able to face it. The intellectual does not have the natural means of resisting the Jewish peril because his instincts have been badly blunted. Because of this fact, the nations with a high standard of civilization are exposed to this peril first and foremost." So I'll stop with that. And, you know, we are that civilization who is exposed to the peril more than any other, and we're the ones who have to understand how to fight it. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.